From WYPR, I'm Sheila Cast. We're on the record. By the time Maryland got around to ending slavery, 152 years ago next week, the Confederacy was within months of collapsing. Black people in the District of Columbia had been free for more than 2 years, and President Lincoln had declared emancipation in the South more than a year and a half earlier. What took Maryland so long?
They stuck their heads in the proverbial sand and hoped the storm would pass over them.
Historian C.R. Gibbs explains how Maryland's elites split over what course to follow, how heroic fighting by black soldiers in the Union Army affected public opinion, and once a new state constitution to abolish slavery was put to referendum, how close the vote was. It's On the Record after the news.
You're listening to On the Record, the podcast, a service of your public radio, 88.1 WYPR. Find more podcasts online at wypr.org. And tell us what you think. Send an email to ontherecord@wypr.org.
Good morning, I'm Sheila Cast. We're On the Record. In a few days, Maryland will mark the 152nd anniversary of the official end of slavery here. On November 1, 1864, after a close referendum, Maryland enacted a constitution which included these words: "That hereafter in this state there shall be neither slavery nor involuntary servitude, except in punishment of crime, whereof the party shall have been duly convicted, and all persons held to service or labor as slaves are hereby declared free." That's Article 24 of the 1864 Constitution. Our topic this morning is, what took Maryland so long? President Lincoln had abolished slavery in the District of Columbia 2.5 years earlier, in April 1862. And while Lincoln's National Emancipation Proclamation of January 1, 1863, held effect only in the Confederate states, not in the four slaveholding states like Maryland, which had stayed in the Union, still, Lincoln had warned after the bloody Battle of Antietam, Maryland, in September 1862, that he would declare an end to slavery in the rebellious states, and then 3 months later he did so. What was going on in Maryland? This Saturday, at the Reginald F. Lewis Museum, historian C.R. Gibbs will speak about what he calls a hard road to freedom. I spoke with C.R. Gibbs earlier this week. Warning, he quotes a letter from Maryland's Civil War governor that uses the N-word. I started by asking Gibbs, since Lincoln had not run on a platform of abolishing slavery, what did Maryland expect when the Civil War started?
They stuck their heads in the proverbial sand and hoped the storm would pass over them. What we have to understand is that slavery was a keystone in the state's economy, and the mere mention of freedom presented a host of horrors to Maryland's elite and many small slave-owning farmers. So it ran the gamut. And they were, as the old folk used to say, bound and determined to put that day off for as long as possible.
So paint the picture for us at the beginning of that war of what slavery was in Maryland. How many slaves?
But the interesting thing is that by 1860, the enslaved population and the free population were just about the same, nearly 90,000. Baltimore's free black population was growing. Of course, it lived under a web of restrictions. It was difficult, and many whites regarded free blacks in Maryland as a population that needed to be surveilled, despised, and avoided, except for the work that they did. So it was considered almost like walking on the edge of a sword. If you opened up too much, free blacks would demand even more. And if you kept them close, if you surveilled them, if you followed them, you knew eventually, the more, how shall I say, perceptive pro-slavery folk, that there would be a change coming. And so the idea was to continue to restrict the enslaved population and to control and surveil the free black population.
And paint a picture for us also of the slave owners. Were there only a few slave holders who held many slaves, or was it a pretty spread out form of ownership?
The 1860 census lets us know that every county in the state had some enslaved people in it, but we see concentrations in different parts of the state, so that those who depended upon the labor of enslaved people were predominantly on the Eastern Shore and in Southern Maryland. There were regions of the state that were adamantly against any kind of change, whereas the folks in the northern counties and to the west didn't need to have as heavy reliance. They didn't grow the same kinds of crops. They didn't have the same kinds of attitudes. There were many Germans in western Maryland who just sort of had an almost genetic predisposition against slavery. So they did not support it. That meant, if you will, a sort of split personality in the state of Maryland over the issue of continued enslavement. So you had that one side of your brain is dependent upon it, and the other side of your brain can sort of take or leave the institution.
And how did attitudes in Maryland change as the war unfolded?
I suppose we could go back to a comment that Governor Hicks made in 1861. He said, "I care nothing for the devilish nigger difficulties. I desire to save the Union and will cooperate with the administration in everything that is proper." And we have every reason to believe he didn't think it would be proper to liberate Maryland's enslaved population. But it was clear that Maryland approached loyalty with a majority of its white population, although there was tremendous division, because you had loyalist slave owners and you had loyalists who saw that slavery's death was almost imminent.
That's historian C.R. Gibbs here on The Record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast. He's speaking Saturday at the Reginald F. Lewis Museum about how emancipation came to Maryland and what took so long. April 16th, 1862, emancipation in the District of Columbia. How did that come about?
Emancipation in the district was actually a rather, as well, long process. For the previous 30 years, there had been attempts by free blacks through battles in the courts and highlighting the dangers and extreme brutality of enslavement. Also, they were aided by regular white citizens who abhorred seeing slave coffles in the nation's capital. And of course, foreign visitors were aghast. We have to understand that Washington, D.C. was the last major Western capital to continue to have an active slave trade and enslavement. And then the war comes, and freedom-seeking black folk leave Maryland for the district and believing, hoping, praying that they can get their freedom once they cross the border into the District of Columbia.
But for the first years of the war, they were no more free in the district than in Maryland.
Absolutely. The Fugitive Slave Act was in force, even as the military spilled into the city to protect it. Many freedom-seeking black folk were turned back. That process would not be finally and conclusively dealt with until 1864. But in the meantime, in those two tumult-filled years, there was a slow change in the public attitude in and around D.C. I suppose as soldiers and others saw the firsthand effects of enslavement, the lashed backs, the instruments of torture, they began to see this is something that affects people who I am learning are just like me. They have the same desires and feelings. They respond to pain. They experience joy. And so we see this in the military camps around D.C., and we also see it spread to the military camps in Southern Maryland, in Frederick, in Hagerstown. More and more of the soldiers are turning against those slave owners who are coming into their camps seeking their property. And they're telling these slave owners, you know, get out, give them the bayonet.
So was it an act of Congress that emancipated the slaves in the district? An act of...
In fact, President Lincoln believed that he had the authority to do so. And so on April 16th, 1862, he signs an act to essentially end enslavement in the nation's capital. It wouldn't be quite that easy in a lot of other places, although, of course, the success of D.C. emancipation emboldened Lincoln to in June, issue a document ending enslavement in the Western Territories. Then in September of 1862, he issues the preliminary emancipation, which you can call a kind of heads up. In other words, he's letting the United States citizenry know that I'm going to do something big come January the 1st, 1863.
We need to take a quick break here. When On the Record comes back, we'll continue discussing the end of slavery in Maryland 152 years ago with historian C.R. Gibbs. I'm Sheila Cass. Stay tuned.
This is the On the Record podcast, a service of Your Public Radio, member-supported 88.1 WYPR. You can support this podcast and everything you hear from WYPR. Become a member. Come to WYPR.org and click the donate link.
Welcome back to On the Record. I'm Sheila Cast. 5 days after the bloody Battle of Antietam in Western Maryland in September 1862, President Lincoln formally warned the Southern states that unless they returned to the Union, he would abolish slavery. We're speaking about emancipation and what led up to it with historian C.R. Gibbs. He's presenting the Maryland Emancipation Anniversary Lecture on Saturday afternoon at the Reginald F. Lewis Museum. You know, in retrospect, it doesn't seem to us that the threat to the Southern states, come back to the Union or lose your slaves, that really could have ended the rebellion. How did it look to people at the time?
Well, there were people who understood that the great unused force would be the possibility of black men fighting for the Union Army. And that was a game changer. And so what sped up the entire process was the need of the Union for manpower. And to know that by the time the war was over, Maryland would send 6 regiments of black men, over 8,700 individuals the state would get credit for joining the Union Army, is extraordinary. To go from half the population is free, half is enslaved, to go to something where black men are wearing the Union Army uniform, fighting, dying, and winning medals for bravery, it seemed to many that the world had turned upside down, at least inside the borders of the state of Maryland.
You said Maryland would get credit for the enlistment of black soldiers counted against Maryland's quota to come up with soldiers for the Union Army?
And so many small farmers were happy to have blacks enlist because that would mean less white men who had to go.
Frederick Douglass had left Maryland, the former slave. What effect did he have on the debate about emancipation in Maryland?
Frederick Douglass was an unwavering voice for freedom and for the enlistment of black soldiers. He could be depended upon to lay out in beautiful oratorical terms the very necessity of arming black men and the illogic of keeping people who you are already using them as contraband labor. So does it not make sense then, in order to help save the Union, for you to use, if you will, your strong black arm? Another writers would call this the sable arm, the use of black soldiers. Douglass believed in it so much, his sons enlisted, Lewis and Charles, enlisted in the Union Army and fought with courage and distinction. And he even sought his best to use every ounce of his influence to get a recruiting commission in order to further recruit. But even though that didn't happen, he spent his own money and much of his time going around the country, reminding people that in the name of fairness, in the name of fitness, indeed, patriotism, it would be necessary for black men to fight for their own freedom.
So by now we're in late 62 or early 63, the Emancipation Proclamation formally issued by President Lincoln taking effect in the rebel states January 1st, 1863. Are slave owners in Maryland by then seeing handwriting on the wall that this institution is going away?
Many of them still have their eyes tucked safely behind their webbed hands. As late as September of 1863, we get a letter from Governor Bradford to ex-Governor Francis Thomas, who says that, "I am satisfied that the conviction has been slowly but surely maturing in the minds of our people for years past that the future growth and prosperity of our state demanded a change in our system of labor, and that the events of the last 2 years have only served to show the necessity of providing for that change with the least possible delay." But Governor Bradford wanted people not to get too excited over this. Now, when we speak of gradual emancipation, it must not be supposed that the phrase is employed by any way of postponement, but it is honestly expresses what it truly means, that such emancipation shall only be so gradual as to guard it against the evil consequences that must necessarily result to slave as well as master from too sudden a change. Nor will anyone imagine that in speaking of emancipation by legal or practical means, we mean to embarrass or delay the project. Well, you can't have it both ways. The more perceptive understood that black folk are leaving our state. If we don't do something, the greatest part of our labor force will simply relocate. And then what are we going to do? We have harvest coming up. We have another planting season. We better do something and do it quick.
A couple of things about the reaction of blacks in Maryland to the Emancipation Proclamation. How did they react to it emotionally? Do we have any record? Here they're seeing their president call for abolition of slavery, or at least a temporary end during the war, in the states to the South. How did that play among blacks in Maryland?
I recall a Baltimore newspaper complaining that our slaves are walking off every day, and the slightest coercion to compel moderate labor, and they are seized with a desire to walk off to a free state. And that was one of the horrible consequences. If you give them freedom, how can we then compel them to work? Well, how about a little thing called salary? You know, that tends to motivate any working man or woman. But they hadn't made that connection just yet. But it's all right. Black folk are not going to wait for them to make that connection. They're going to show their desire for freedom with their feet and with the strength of their arms by picking up a Union rifled musket.
How easy was it for slaves at that point to walk away from bondage in Maryland?
During the early part of the war, of course, when you ran the risk of being returned to your master, it was fraught with all kinds of dangers. But these are dangers that many black folk were willing to take. But after the Emancipation Proclamation, which clearly says that it's okay to accept black men into the forts and garrisons of the United States, the floodgates come. And after this, Union recruiting officers demand access to Maryland's black population.
This is On the Record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cass speaking with historian C.R. Gibbs about what led to the end of slavery in Maryland. On Saturday at 1 p.m., Gibbs will speak at the Reginald F. Lewis Museum, a lecture he's titled A Hard Road to Freedom. So we're past the Emancipation Proclamation. You're painting this picture of a lot of black people in Maryland, including enslaved people, leaving the state. Who in Maryland thought a new state constitution was needed? What did they want to accomplish with the state constitution?
Over the issue of the speed of freedom, even those loyal Marylanders who believed in the Union come what may, understood that a component of the Union victory would be the death of slavery. And even they split over the speed of emancipation and how to manage this. And ultimately, they worked out the idea of a constitutional convention.
So the political elite, who are the ones who, I assume, draft a constitution and go through the steps needed to get it in front of voters for a vote, the political elite was basically saying it's time to abolish slavery.
Yes, the operative term now is manage it. How can we placate the Eastern Shore? How can we manage it to placate Southern Maryland? What can we do to quiet the concerns of the farmers about the speed of it in North and Western Maryland? And remember, some of the strongest pro-slavery voices have left. They're fighting for the Confederacy. So we're talking about people with Unionist sympathies who will vote. But even with that, it is nip and tuck as to whether this new constitution will pass.
Nip and tuck is a good way to describe how close it is. People who actually were living on Maryland soil at the time were voting in October of 1864. When their votes were counted, how did it look?
The vote itself, if we had to sort of break it out in percentages, it was about 50.3 to 49.64.
Looking back at it, do you think the fact that it was such a tight margin played some role in how the new Constitution was implemented, what kind of effect it had?
I think that that was certainly a chief concern. I mean, we're looking at the soldiers' vote, 263 against 2,633 for. So that was it. That was the lever that pushed it over. And a dawn of a new era, at least the end of slavery, opened in Maryland. Could truly call itself on November the 1st, 1864, the free state.
So as of November 1st, 1864, black people were free in Maryland. Were they citizens? Did they have the vote?
No, they did not. And to sort of telescope this story, it's going to take until a new constitution in 1867 clears that up. In the meantime, the pro-slavery power reasserts itself, and there are examples, just chilling examples, of effective re-enslavement. Just one quick example, there's a case called Ex parte Elizabeth Turner in 1867, in which Justice Chase, the Supreme Court, struck down an attempt to keep Elizabeth Turner enslaved. So integration, we've got integration that needs to be done, we've got enforcement of civil rights, we've got citizenship and the right to vote that remain goals that Maryland must achieve in the future.
You've talked about the concern of the elites in Maryland about how much of the black labor force was leaving the state. Was Maryland dragged into emancipation from a sense of pragmatism or a sense of justice?
Reluctant, extremely reluctant pragmatism by the members of the Unionist Party, Hugh Lennox Bond, Bradford, the governor, and others, sought to guide the state into something that was going to happen regardless. It was going to happen, or Maryland would pay an even larger price economically. And this is, again, one of the overriding factors that made pragmatism a reluctant oar in the ship of state.
Historian C.R. Gibbs will speak about emancipation in Maryland at 1 p.m. Saturday at the Reginald F. Lewis Museum on East Pratt Street in Baltimore. His lecture is titled, A Hard Road to Freedom. Thank you so much for talking to us.
Oh, you're very welcome. Thank you.
I'm Sheila Cass. Thanks for listening to On the Record. Join us tomorrow.